Yeah, maybe just to admit again, I've really enjoyed just sitting here with you in silence, and there's quite a part of me that would prefer that. But at the same time, quite keen to explore a few more things, and it's really nice to have the opportunity to do that. So let's go ahead. Maybe the first thing to say is this is a really kind of precious moment in a retreat. You know, we've had quite some days of practice building up and cultivation and support and all of this. And there's, you know, a lot of work goes into making this possible for us to be here, from the teams that are here, but also, you know, people in our lives who are supporting us to be here and all of that. And just really wanting to honor and you know, respect that and name it in the place. And also, it's not like, you know, all of those days have happened and now we're about to go home. We've actually still got like a this evening and the whole full day tomorrow and the morning after that to bear and struggle through and all of this. And also to take delight in and enjoy and continue to deepen and nourish ourselves. Yeah. So, yeah, it's precious, precious that we've invested this and we still have time to enjoy it. And what a great place. What a great place to be able to do this. You know, not heaven, you know, not perfection or anything like this, but a really delightful place. You know, just a simple example. I was just, you know, well, I like to be here. I like to move around with really kind of open senses. Maybe others do as well. Like just listening, taking in all the bird life, all the nature life, all the human life, all the village over there and the movements of ourselves. I think, it's just so nice to have that big, wide open thing. And then right, something's biting my foot at the same time. It's like, so really great just to be able to kind of practice with all of that. You know, perfect conditions for a retreat. I think it's a mixture of heaven and dukkha together in so much to practice with. And yeah, let's talk about dukkha. It's the most enjoyable of topics. So first off, I really want to say something that, you know, the Buddha was teaching something really profound, right? And just what, as much as I can talk about it tonight, is going to be quite limited in terms of what's going on there. And that's why I'm really happy that we have the full translation as well. I'm also going to try and remind myself and anyone who can pick up on it that if I say something that you think might be confusing, then you call out to me. It's like, let's get a translation for that. Let's clarify that word. Yeah. And then hopefully we can just kind of dance through these teachings and end up with something reasonably useful. If you've been feeling like you haven't quite connected with some of the materials before on the retreat, then maybe this is the talk for you. And and if you have actually really connected with other things from this retreat, or you've brought in from other places, then don't feel that, you know, everything has to be for you. Yeah, it's a little bit like walking around indoor. This talk might be an insect biting your foot, but it might not. It might not. We'll have to see. So the Buddha taught something really profound, and simply put, you know, the ending of dukkha. The ending of dukkha. Amazing, you know, that this was discovered, this was felt to be, and this is what these teachings are for, this is what they share. But then we have this word dukkha. Well, what does that mean? What does it actually mean? And that's part of what I want to be exploring tonight. But just so that we can continue to work forwards from there, I would say dukkha is anything that is hard to bear, hard to be with, yeah, hard to live alongside, hard to have in our life. That's what dukkha is. I mean, it's hard to bear, things that feel hard to bear. Yeah. Does that make sense as a phrase? Hard to bear, hard to carry, hard to be with. Yeah, okay, good. Second thing to bear in mind, and what also maybe proves that it's quite profound, is that Buddha really hesitated to teach what they discovered, what they experienced, so to say. Not easy to understand. But then, you know, the story goes, they realized there were some beings that just had a little bit of dust in their eyes and they could, you know, they could pick it up, they could get into it, they could experience it. Most of us, most of the time, we really love to have things, you know, simple and clear and precise and, you know, just tell me what I need to do and I'll get on with it. And something's called, we love a base, you know, we love our base, our supports, our structures, our forms, our this's and that's. And yet the Buddha was saying, you know, this is like something you've never seen. This is some peace beyond peace, something really transcendent, sublime, not easy to see. And yet, as we said already, sweet in the beginning. So that's good news, right? So however much we already get, yeah, anything at all that we understand of the dependent origination of our experience, like what we pay attention to and how we pay attention to it, it's quite immediate. We can actually start to gain some of that sweetness, some of that sublime, some of that transcendence here and now, just through meeting our experience well. Yeah. So it's sweet in the beginning and it's also sweet in the middle, sweet in the end. And each of those sweetnesses are what they call onward leading. Onward leading. They lead onwards. They deepen, they extend, they expand, they continue in this way. And what they do is progressively unbind the dukkha that's hard to bear. Yeah. And unbind, also related to unbound, yeah, something that doesn't have bounds, doesn't have boundaries, is expansive, it's limitless, it's expansive, spacious, in all those kind of ways, beyond spacious. So how do we get there? Yeah, how do we do this? What's the path? And in short, it's a path of lessening reactivity. So in the famous Four Noble Truths of the Buddha, there's a second part of the Noble Truths where it in everyday language we could say the Buddha saying, when there's dukkha, what else is there? Right. When there's this dukkha experience, when life is hard to bear, what else is happening? Yeah. And the Buddha, being a intelligent, smart guy who wanted to teach, was actually not asking us that question directly. He was perfectly willing to answer it. And so the Buddha says, well, it's tanha. It's this, some people translate it as craving. In English, we don't use craving a lot in the language, but it kind of means this kind of demanding desire for things. And so when that's there, there's dukkha. When there's demanding desires, when there's tanha, kind of literally means thirst, thirsting for things, thirsting for position, thirsting not to be around, yeah, to be asleep, to be unconscious. So those kinds of thirstings happen there. I think it's a little bit tricky with this word desire that kind of comes in, because there also needs to be kind of a strong desire for awakening in the path, you know, a strong desire to kind of move through difficult times, a strong desire for freedom, you know, for beauty, for, you know, when we started off the retreat, speaking about like, what do you want more of? What do you want to plant seeds of? What do you want to help develop to grow? You need a desire for that, desire that that could come into being. So personally, in my own way of phrasing it, I've actually just dropped the desire bit and it's just demanding. Yeah. When you're being demanding, it's dukkha. It's hard to bear. Yeah. And other people have asked me to say this, but when you're demanding, you're hard to bear as well, to be honest. Okay, so stop it. And you're causing dukkha to us. No, it's okay. You're not really. You're really not. But like, yeah, when we're in a demanding situation with things, demanding for these pleasures, demanding for these displeasures to go, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to be like that. And the Buddha's given this kind of short answer. So what else is there when there's dukkha? Oh, it's this demanding. But when there's demanding, what else is there? Or when there's dukkha, what else is there? And something that we'll notice is there's also this kind of contraction. Do you notice that in your experience? It's like this kind of tightness, shrinking away, contractedness. Sometimes it's physiological, you really feel it in your body, and you can actually feel, I don't need to do that. And part of the reminder in meditation is actually to open, to loosen, to relax that, but it doesn't only happen in the body. It can also happen, say energetically. You feel like it's gotten tight. Maybe the posture hasn't changed, but energetically it can also open, flow more. Yeah, it's a contraction in the flow of the energy in the system. When there's strong demanding, you'll also notice that there's quite a contraction in the attention and in the awareness that goes with that. Yeah, that also makes sense. You can feel that, notice that. So we could say, when there's dukkha, there's demanding. It's like, yes, that's helpful. But there's also this energetic component. So you remember with the hindrances, we could have greed and aversion. They're kind of tanha, right? They're the demanding thing. But we also have this restlessness, dullness, this kind of disturbance in the energetics. We can play with that on this level. Yeah, it's also helpful to see there's actually always many possibilities. Now, what's another interesting thing is that if you reduce that contraction, you also reduce the demanding. Yeah, so the energetics, the awareness, the physicality, all of that. If you loosen that contraction, you also soften the demanding. The demanding needed the contraction. The contraction needed the demanding. They dependently arose upon each other. Yeah, they don't survive separately. Yeah. Some people are nodding. Is anyone shaking? Does anyone think? No, I can do one without the other. I think we were actually talking about this morning, whether it was possible. I think it's not possible, but if someone's been able to do it, I'm always happy to hear. Okay. Well, you can let me know. You can leave me a note if you want. And so there we have kind of like two ways of changing the recipe. Changing the recipe changes the outcome of what we produce. Yeah. So what are we doing that's leading to dukkha? And then there's also this question, so what are we doing that's leading away from it, leading to well-being? Yeah, let's go here. So has anyone here heard of Shinzen Young? A few people? Yeah. Shinzen Young. Okay, so reasonably known and reasonably unknown, as the room shows. So he's a teacher. He came up with this idea. I think he might be a little bit kind of sciencey, mathematical, something into this stuff. And he kind of proposed an algorithm or a formula for understanding dukkha. And he said, dukkha is, and apologies if I'm misquoting him because this is entirely from my memory. Dukkha is pain times reactivity. Yeah. So you take some degree of pain, multiply it by your reactivity, your demandingness. Yeah. And then you that's about how much dukkha you're going to get. And so the key thing is the reactivity is something that we bring into the situation. Like life is painful. Of course it is. Yeah. There's painfulness in life. And life can be hard to bear, but it becomes more harder to bear when we add in the reactivity. Yeah, and we get a more hard to bear experience. Does that feel like something we might have noticed in our life? Yeah. And so, it's helpful to see it this way. And so we could say, our journey is to lessen our reactivity to what feels painful, which feels unpleasant, not hopefully, not making it worse. When there's less reactivity, there's less dukkha. It's a more pleasant way of being. And yeah, as people are saying, you've seen this in your life, seen it hopefully over the days here, and also seen it over the months, over the years, over the path of existence. Yeah. So what's the best way to be non-reactive? What's the best way to reduce that reactivity? No? Okay. Right. Types of doing can actually be really effective for undoing this reactivity. And that's what I want to spend a little bit of time talking about. So actually, let's just name one thing about this formula. So if you had a zero of reactivity, like no reactivity at all, and if you know your mathematics, if you multiply pain, let's say pain goes up on a 100-point scale, even if we had 100 on the pain scale and we times it by zero, right, then that would presumably mean that we would have zero dukkha. Okay, so I'm just questioning Shinzen Young's mathematics here. Or is that true? If there is no reactivity, is there actually no dukkha? Okay, now maybe that's what the Buddha was wanting to teach, and also why the Buddha hesitated, because the mathematics was rather strong and the principles here seem a bit odd, because it seems like, well, there's pain, but there's no suffering, there's no dukkha, there's no stress, there's no distress, and there's pain. How odd. And yet, you know, we could extend this a little bit that, and I put up that quote from Rollo May about the gap between stimulus and response and that quality of freedom. So the stimuli of some kind of sensation becomes pain because of some degree of reactivity to it. Does that also make sense? Right. Stimuli times reactivity equals pain, Shinzen Young. New formula for you, buddy. So where did your pain come from? Your pain actually demands a certain degree of reactivity. Now, you don't have to be on board with this new groundbreaking theory for now. Right? I'm going to explain a little bit more, and it's not my theory, of course. I mean, it's actually my playful algorithm, but it's just to kind of start to be making a point. But then again, you know, if there's no reactivity to that stimuli, what happens? What happens? And this is actually what the Buddha is saying. It's actually saying if you completely lose your reactivity to things, nothing appears. And this is a principle you can also explore through the degree of contraction. Yeah. To have something held in attention, to pay attention to something, it's holding it in attention. And there's a certain tension in attention. I don't know if that's meant to be there in the poetry of the etymology or whatever, but holding that in, and if you don't hold it, attention isn't holding anything and nothing appears, including pain. You know, and this is what the Buddha's saying. It's like, actually, do you understand that your experience is fabricated? It's fabricated. It's fabricated, and it needs some reactivity. Okay. I wonder if this is... Let's see if we can do this relatively quickly, because I want to get onto something else. But like, let's speak a little bit about that reactivity level. So there's a principle. It's in Pali, it's called Vedana. It's a really fascinating part of the teachings. Simply put, it's the categorization of experience. But let's come at it from an example. Right? Close your eyes. Imagine you've just come into the dining room, and there are there's like six things in front of you. Yeah, there's some fresh fruit. Oh, fresh fruit, really glistening, fresh, delightful fruit. There's some hot chips, potato fries. Oh, I'm just really like salted the way you like. I mean, they're just fantastic, yeah. And then there's some cold porridge from 3 days ago. And there's a, like a moldy cucumber that's really, it's limp and it's that whitish stuff on it, you know, like forgotten at the back of the refrigerator kind of thing. So they've put that on the table. There's matzot and a glass of water. Okay. Now there's six things here and they probably evoke different levels of appealingness to you. Yeah. Like some of those things I know for myself are really appealing. Yeah. And even if I've just brushed my teeth, I mean, I could brush them again. Yeah. And some of them, it would just, no, not appealing at all. And some of them are like, you know, I mean, if that's all there is, you know, I'll have it. Right. So those particular feelings, those, if we put those into three camps, those are called the three types of Vedana. Some things appear appealing, pleasant, nice, desirable, that would bring me happiness. There's also a way that we could describe that. Some things feel unpleasant, painful, disgusting. I don't want that. Yeah, that would make my life worse. It would take happiness out of my existence. It feels like, yeah. It wouldn't, but it feels like it would. And there's some things which are like, meh. Not bothered. I mean, take it, leave it. Yeah. Okay. So that was no slander to any of those things. You know, I think they're all great. I think they're all great. They're all just sensory experiences. But what we see is that it very quickly leads into desire, aversion, and withdrawal of attention. Like all of that kind of stuff that we overlook. Right, and all three of those things are actually reactivity. They're actually reactivity. We're incredibly reactive people, just by nature. By perceiving something, there's reactivity in it. Yeah, but we could actually respond in really different ways. Respond in really different ways to all of that. And what's kind of fascinating with this idea is to. If you get to understand life at this level, you actually get to see, you get to unlock this secret door. It's like, I'm projecting that onto experience. It doesn't inherently have those qualities. And then I respond to that in a way which causes contraction in my life. And that's all quite optional. Yeah. That's why we share this teaching, because it's, I think Zoya likes to call it the get out of jail card. Yeah, it's the get out of dukkha card. It's like, I'm believing my Vedanas. My Vedanas. I didn't come up with them. You know, they come through us. They're there every time there is contact with stimuli. Stimuli, contact, sense door, sense object, and Vedana comes in, right? Because there's three Vedanas. There's the Vedana, this is pleasant. This is unpleasant, and this is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Okay? So that's a comprehensive list. You don't need a fourth. Like, what would the fourth be? Both? I mean, could something be both? I suppose. Yeah? But it's either pleasant, it's felt to be unpleasant, or it's felt to be neither of those. Right? And that drives us into this thirsting, into this demanding kind of relationship, right? It doesn't have to, but it tends to, right? And so when we bring in wisdom, sensitivity, creativity, then we're on the path of freedom, right? Until we bring that in, we don't see that it's subjective, right? It's about this in this moment. We don't see that it's transient. It's only going to be like this for a while, yeah? You know, chips are only desirable in small portions. Anyone who's eaten too many chips will know that, you know, you can have too much of this thing, or whatever else it is, yeah? And it's changeable. One of the lovely ways I like to play with this as a practice is actually seeing, you know, all of these things that I overlook. What if I start bringing in a different attitude towards them? So, you know, we've joked a few times that the breath isn't interesting. Yeah, until you stop breathing, then it becomes more interesting. That there's a good atmosphere here, that we have the capacity to sense, experience, that we're conscious. Like all of these things, we just kind of take them for granted. Miraculous things. Amazing things. So when we bring a different attitude towards them, these neither nor Vedana, not pleasant, not unpleasant, actually become quite pleasant, quite enjoyable, quite delightful. And what that means is they depend on the way of relating to them, depend on the way of meeting them. And yeah. And so we want to be able to see this path as a way of bringing more wholesome, skillful ways of relating to experience. Yeah. And what I want to just spend a little bit of time, maybe the last 10, 15 minutes of the talk, is just speaking about some beautiful, sublime attitudes that we can have, some really limitless ways of meeting. And so the sublime attitudes is in reference to the demanding attitudes that we can have. Yeah, and the limitless ways of relating are much more to do with those limited, contractive, you know, ways of meeting experience. So some of you will know these, and they're called the Brahmaviharas, yeah, also called the illimitable qualities of the heart mind, as I say, the sublime attitudes. You can put it in various ways. Brahmaviharas would mean like divine abodes, the home of the gods, which they can feel like at times. And we've been practicing them. Yeah, metta is one of them. And, you know, the way that we practice it today is actually, you know, really from the teachings themselves, you know, that we were, you know, it says, a practitioner suffuses the world, like, spreads their good vibes in the world in four directions, in four directions with a, let's say, a practitioner suffuses the world in the four directions with a mind of benevolence, that's metta, yeah, and then with compassion, with appreciative joy, and with equanimity, then above and below and all around the whole world from all sides, completely with a benevolent, all-embracing, great, boundless, peaceful, and friendly mind. Just as a powerful conch blower, the or Scops owl, makes themselves heard with no great effort in all four directions, so too there is no limit to the unfolding of this heart-liberating benevolence. This is a way to commune in with Brahma, with God. And so we build the path, right? We build the path on these intentions, on these practices, on this intentionality to bring this to all things, to all beings, but also to all elements of experience. And so can I bring a sense of benevolence? And can we understand what that means, what that comes to be? So I'm talking about the Brahmaviharas even more than just metta, because I want us to be able to meet these, you know, three categories of experience that we displayed with the six ingredients in the kitchen sensibility of Vedana. Yeah. So we could say that there are four Brahmaviharas. And quickly ran through them in that bit from the text. Let's just presume for now, let's adopt the mythology that they're all forms of metta. So metta is the first of the Brahmaviharas, but then metta, you know, wears different cloaks, takes different shapes, acts in different ways, is a creative chameleon of a quality. And when it meets hardship in the world, it becomes compassion. Yeah. So it's benevolence, it's friendliness, it's goodwill. It meets some pain, becomes compassion, it wants to heal, it wants to resolve. Yeah. In its so that's its second variation. In its third variation, it meets something delightful, something enjoyable, something beautiful, maybe like this owl that is calling relatively mournfully. So it might be compassion for you, but it's hopefully someone like it is listening and saying, cool, and it's calling back. It seems there's only one, so I don't know. It could affect you in different ways. And we might say, oh, it's beautiful. And we delight and we enjoy and we appreciate and we have joy for it to be having a place to be and a place to sing. And then there's this third quality, this really, really hard to talk about quality called, you know, equanimity, upekkha. And it's responsive, but it's also kind of impartial. Yeah. You know what impartiality means? Not taking a side between things, like really even-minded, really even-hearted, quite still, quite spacious, very spacious, very still, actually, not quite, but like serene, yeah, but not untouched, not unmoved, not separate in that way, yeah? not distant. Not from distance, you know, like something very, I say, really, really hard to put into language, something very sublime. And also, again, you know, what the Buddha was kind of pointing towards. But that's a different way of relating to something than like glass of water, I'm not really bothered. Yeah, kind of like, not something of real substance. So is that clear? Is that clear how that maps towards the Vedana kind of thing? Yeah. So we have metta, just benevolence to all things. We're non-demanding. It's not a demanding relationship. It's really kind of bright, clear, connected, kind. But then when we meet something pleasant, we can actually enjoy it, delight in it, yeah? Find it uplifting. And maybe, like I said before, when we talked about the hindrances, we turn it into an act of generosity. Give that to someone or encourage someone else to see it that way or share in that, delight in that. When we meet something that's painful, we care about it. You know, we try to soothe or ease or resolve or heal. You know, the heart really resonates at that level, that empathetic quality. We deeply care. And then there's this very sublime, very otherworldly relationship to things, what we might call equanimity. And the equanimity principle also starts to actually fade things again. Yeah. So we're back in this realm of the fading of things, because it's, well, here's something that stands true in my experience, although I didn't hear it anywhere else from wise beings that I respect, but they may have said it and I may have just thought that I came up with it, but so test it in your own experience. But like, we could say tanha, demanding, is unhelpful. Yeah, you know, we can kind of see that, and if we lessen that, we lessen the dukkha. But lessen it to what? You know, so one way would be let's just try and subtract it. Another way is we could just flip it into metta. And so metta has a very kind of positive relationship, a very benevolent relationship. So this thing I used to be demanding of, I'm actually bringing more benevolence, more kindness, more soothing, more all of that. Yeah, and we actually see our experience change when we bring in that way. So imagine the demanding is towards a pain in the body. We've already kind of been through something similar to this. It's like, but rather than reject it, push it away, we can actually allow it to be there, allow ourselves to meet it, and maybe that metta becomes like compassion in that way. Give it space, allow it to be. And we can even, and this might seem outside the range, this might be something you've already practiced, we can actually really welcome this painful sensation into the heart mind, into the being, into presence. Actually really, hey, how are you doing? What do you need? And very, very transformative. Yeah. Actually doesn't keep being unpleasant in that way. which is suggestive of things we were saying earlier, which is actually it's the reactivity to the stimuli that creates the pain. Without that reactivity, it becomes something else. But equanimity is actually suggesting something different again. So here we have metta is the opposite of demanding. Yeah. So the opposite of demanding is it's contradistinction. It's a different way of approaching, and it creates different experience, much less dukkha. Equanimity is the absence. It's the absence of demanding. Now, it's not being replaced by its opposite, kindness, welcoming. Yeah, it's the opposite of rejection. Yeah, it's anyone who's noticed that in experience. Yeah, like friends are the opposite of enemies, right? Yeah. But then there's the absence, just the absence of demanding. And what does that do for experience when we subtract the demanding? And that's really something that the Buddha was suggesting to try and supporting us in that direction can be this path of non-contraction, non-grasping, non-demanding. Yeah. Something that we can tune into and encourage, surprisingly enough, the fading of all things, which isn't quite as bad as it sounds. Yeah. If we look at the experience of, say, happiness, there's not a lot of self, there's not a lot of world, there's not a lot of substantiality to the feeling of happiness. Do you feel that? Do you recognize that? It's like, ah, really, what we call delightful, lighter, much lighter. Yeah, we're much less kind of passionate about the things. It's like, ah, the laughter, the lightness, the soothing, the ease that we can experience in ourselves. There's something about that, something about the stilling of the reactivity that's really nourishing, really supportive. And I think that's, you know, we can begin to feel that in that lessening of the contraction. So just imagine now, whatever contraction you can notice in your heart, in your mind, in your body, in your being, in your awareness, just letting that soften, letting that soothe, letting that calm, letting that still. Whatever remains, it's okay. That's what remains. And seeing now, it's the same thread, and we just go again. Whatever's here, stilling with that. Not pushing, not pulling, but not withdrawing. And so these sublime qualities that we can bring to our experience, and you know, you don't have to go to equanimity. It might be very appealing, but it might be more the appreciation, the delight, the enjoyment that we choose to do. It might be more the compassion, the soothing, the being with, the empathy, all of those. So worth practicing, so worth prioritizing in our life, yeah? Especially when they feel distant. Especially when they feel distant. And I would say, I've said before, and I still agree with myself from all those months ago, is I think it's one of the most impressive things is to meet someone who's practicing kindness, goodwill, benevolence in a situation where there isn't so much. Yeah, someone who's practicing compassion, appreciation, where there isn't so much. Someone who's practicing non-demanding in a place that's really full of demands, full of all the stresses and the pains that come from that. I really admire that in people. I really admire each of you for what you're doing, what you're choosing to do, what you're willing to be with to do this. And then what I'd say is to meet life through the lens of these Brahma-viharas is is really to come to life in a very uncommon sense of that, really coming to life. And I think that for me, that means both ways. We actually come more into contact with existence, and we actually really blossom, bloom, spring into life in ourselves. So, yeah, thank you for listening to this. Thank you for your practice, and let's have a moment together of meeting what we have here in a way that supports these sublime attitudes. Thank you again for your practice and your willingness to be here, especially for anyone who's really finding it difficult to be here, difficult this time. We wish you well. Take just over half an hour for some walking and come back for the chanting and the last sit.